Airplane Intel Podcast, episode 55. In this episode, we interview a longtime listener and airplane owner to find out exactly what it's like to own a popular single-engine Cessna. We'll dive into a variety of topics today, including the purchase process, aircraft ownership costs, maintenance, and lessons learned. So if you're thinking about buying an airplane, stay tuned.
Welcome to the Airplane Intel Podcast, the show for aircraft owners, pilots, and mechanics. It's our goal to save you money and make your flying safer so you can get the most out of your airplane. Featuring the pre-buy guys with over 60 years combined experience flying, maintaining, and managing all types of aircraft. We will share practical advice, strategies, and tips to help make aircraft ownership simple, safe, and cost-effective. So stay tuned.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Airplane Intel Podcast. We're an aviation podcast that focuses on the ins and outs of aircraft ownership. I'm Adam. I'm an AMPIA pilot, Marine Corps veteran, and Embry-Riddle graduate. And together, my co-host Don and I share our insights and experiences from our years in the field and interview aircraft owners and industry experts to get the facts about aircraft ownership. All of this with the goal of helping you make safer and smarter decisions with your personal or business aircraft. Now, over the past year and a half, we've had the privilege of interviewing a lot of airplane owners and aviation experts. We've covered a wide variety of airplanes from piston singles to jets, but today we're going to learn about an airplane that's not only affordable, but also makes a great first airplane for a lot of you guys out there. You've probably even flown one at a time in your flight training career. In fact, our guest today bought his airplane before completing his private pilot certificate. Can you guess what it is? Well, it's the good old-fashioned Cessna 150. But this isn't just any Cessna 150. Our guest has one very interesting modification done, but I'll let him tell you about it. But first, a quick introduction. Our guest today is Mitch, and he lives way out west near Omaha, Nebraska. And after many years away from flying, he began private pilot training in October of 2017. And in December of that year, he purchased his 1971 Cessna 150L. He completed his private training earlier this year and has accumulated about 110 hours on his plane. Now, he's in the early stages of his instrument training and hopes to get a tailwheel endorsement in the near future. Now, Mitch is a pretty interesting guy with some great stories, insights, and advice about aircraft ownership. So, without further ado, let's get right to it. We're here with Mitch Schneringer, the owner of a 1971 Cessna 150. Hey, Mitch, we welcome you to the podcast, and thanks for spending some time with us.
Absolutely. Great to be here, Adam. Thank you.
Yeah, and, you know, we talked via email, and you mentioned that you own a Cessna 150, and, of course, we wanted to talk to you about that. So before we get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in aviation?
Okay. Well, I live just outside Omaha, Nebraska, and I grew up in rural Nebraska, and I became interested in aviation as a young child because my grandfather, he had a Piper Cub, and he also had a Molly of some version, but he used to take me around flying, and I just have these awesome memories of going up with him. We'd land on this rural grass strip, and we'd do it, you know, once, maybe twice a week. And I can just remember all these fun adventures. And, you know, one time I can even remember that he put floats on the plane and we landed on one of the nearby lakes. And I'll just never forget those great memories. Unfortunately, it all kind of came to a halt, though, when I was 9 years old because he'd spent the winter building an ultralight in his garage. And in March of 1984, he took it on a flight and, you know, he never made it back. So,
oh, wow.
You know, it was kind of a tragic end and to everything. So I wanted to fly for many, many years throughout my life. And, you know, there were some deep family wounds there, and I just never really was able to act upon that. But for my 42nd birthday last year, my wife encouraged me to go sign up for an introductory to flight lesson at our local field here. And so I did that. I started my lessons. And then that was in October of last year. And then in April of this year, I earned my private pilot certificate. So Just, you know, great memories with my grandfather, and I wanted to experience everything that, you know, drew me back to aviation for all those years.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And congratulations on getting your certificate. That's an amazing achievement. And, you know, it's really neat that you still found the inspiration from your grandfather and didn't let that tragic situation stop you from fulfilling that dream of yours of flying. And so that's really neat. And, you know, it's as sad as that is, you know, at least you know he was doing what he loved doing. And that's really, right. That's really significant, I think. And so anyway, glad that you got into it and that you're flying now. That's really neat.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it might sound a little weird, but I actually feel much closer to him flying. So yeah. It's great.
Absolutely. Yeah, cool. And you're absolutely right, because there's that, because you know that you're seeing the same things that he was seeing and experiencing mm-hmm. the same things he was experiencing. And it does bring you closer. Yeah, that's really interesting perspective. So now, let's fast forward a little bit. You've been flying for what, about 6-7 months? And well, with your license.
And right, correct.
Now you own this airplane. So what kind of led you down the path of buying an airplane versus renting?
Well, about 15 hours into my training, you know, with scheduling the rental and a little bit of the somewhat impersonal feeling I had with the aircraft, I just started to become interested in owning my own. And, you know, again, it probably kind of goes back to my grandfather. He owned a few airplanes, and I just kind of thought that that would be, you know, where I wanted to end up. And I never, I mean, I was not in any rush. I definitely want to take this in steps, okay? And, you know, the plane I have now probably isn't my forever plane, but it's, in my opinion, it's the best plane for me at this time. And so to tell you a little bit more about myself, I mean, I'm in the car business. And so, you know, I buy and sell cars for a living. And so it didn't seem too difficult, although, you know, it is much different, to just buy an airplane. Mm. And so I learned lessons on that as well, because it is very, very different.
Yeah.
But I definitely wanted to have, I mean, part of it was not just experiencing the flying, but there's even a little bit of pride of ownership.
Sure.
And so that appealed to me and wanted to, I can remember one time after one of my lessons, one of our local guys at the field there was out there, you know, washing his airplane on a beautiful Sunday afternoon. And I got out and I chatted with him for a little bit. And, you know, it just seemed like something fun to do, just to take a little pride in not just the flying, but the entire experience and everything involved.
Hmm. So you brought up two things that I kind of want to just talk about for a minute. One, the difference between buying an airplane and buying a car. Can you maybe talk to some of our listeners that may not be familiar with, hey, you know, there are similarities, of course, but there are more differences than similarities between buying a car and buying an airplane. Can maybe you mention a couple points that you noticed that were different?
Absolutely. I mean, I could talk at length of the differences because, again, like, I'll buy and sell a car almost sight unseen, and mm-hmm. it's borderline a commodity. But an airplane, I mean, the history of the plane matters so incredibly much more than a car. And, you know, things such as the accident history. You helped me out with a couple of planes I was looking at, you know, back in December. And, you know, there's some things you can uncover with some research, but I didn't really have a whole lot of expertise. That's where you helped me tremendously. That just make you want to just walk from that situation. mm-hmm. You know, in most cases, a car, you know, if it has something in its history, it can be fixed and easily repaired. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not like an airplane where that just kind of sticks with it. And, you know, it's a factor and sometimes a haunting factor forever and ever, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a major difference, is the history versus buying a car. And, you know, one thing I've learned is, and I believe you shared this with me too. I mean, buying the plane, the price is just a part of it. Actually, mm-hmm. your larger expense becomes the operation of the plane. And so that's why I started where I started, you know, because I was looking for something economical to operate, because I wanted a plane that at no point in time did the economics prohibit me from flying it. You know, I need frequency, and I don't really need speed, mm-hmm. Because I'm trying to build hours and experience and everything. So an economical, slow-moving plane was just fine by me. In fact, that's, I actually like just going out and buzzing around the pattern and you know, experiencing that part of flying right now. You know, I do take some cross countries. I just flew 200 miles this past weekend, one way and back, to go play golf out in Western Nebraska. But, you know, it took a little bit of time, but it certainly saved me a lot of time compared to driving.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I feel it's the right plane for me at this point in my experience.
And that's really important, because what I'm hearing from you is that knowing where you're at currently in your skill level and experience level and what you need out of an airplane, you picked an airplane that fit your mission, and you took your time to do the research and due diligence to find an airplane that was not only fitting that mission, but a solid airframe and engine for you to fly it as often right. as you need to for the foreseeable future. And that's really important.
Right. Yeah.
Now, the other point you brought up earlier was that you purchased the airplane while you were still working on your private pilot's license. Now, I would typically, now every situation is different, so let me stress that, but typically, I would recommend that most people should wait to buy an airplane until they're at least done with their private pilot training. So I'd love to get your perspective on how that whole process came about of buying the airplane while still going through training. And did that have any positive or negative effect on the outcome of your training specifically? What kind of things did you learn about aviation that maybe you got a little bit more knowledge a little faster because you were an airplane owner so early on in your aviation flying career?
Right, absolutely. Well, I did sort of go against many people's suggestions by purchasing the plane during my training. But the point I was at was I just couldn't get enough. Mm-hmm. You know, I just wanted to be in that plane more than probably anyone realized. And so, you know, there's no doubt about it. By purchasing the plane, it actually accelerated my training okay. because I flew it so much more often, and I became in much closer connection and familiarity with my plane. And I just felt like I had much more control of a lot of different aspects of the plane. But, you know, I think my instructor would agree that, you know, purchasing the plane was a huge step actually in my development and my acceleration towards getting my license. Hmm. You know, and then once I had the solo endorsement, there's no doubt about it. I mean, at no point in time did scheduling the airplane ever become an issue, because it was always available for me. You know, I had considered, you know, waiting and buying a plane with two or three other people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I owned a boat one time with one other guy. And I mean, we're still friends to this day, but it just wasn't really for me. You know, I like to be in control of the situation. And by having my own plane, it allowed me to take more control of my training. And it definitely, you know, was a great benefit.
Very cool. Yeah, so in your case, it worked out quite well. And I think one of the main reasons for it, your experience being more positive and successful, was picking the right airplane. You know, you weren't thinking, oh, I need a 182 or a Mooney or a Bonanza right now. You realize, okay, but 152 is going to fit everything. It's going to check all the boxes for me, and it's going to enhance your training and make things a little bit more simple for you. And like I said, availability of the airplane, that is a huge thing. Now, obviously, it was very critical to ensure that the airplane was in good mechanical shape, because if there are any mechanical issues, that's typically the area that I would, you know, caution people is, you know, well, if you have a mechanical issue with the airplane, not only are you not you don't have an airplane to fly now, but you're going to be forking out some money to get it fixed. And that, you know, depending on what your training budget is, that might be dipping into your training budget. So,
right.
Can you maybe talk about some of the things that you did to ensure that you got a plane that was, you know, mechanically sound and, you know, in good shape?
Absolutely. To touch on what you said, you know, by owning the plane without anyone else, I did take on risk, you mm-hmm. know, and because 100% of any expense is on my shoulders.
Yeah.
Versus the benefit of renting is, you know, it's not on your shoulders. So, yeah, it's definitely a factor to consider. So in terms of finding this particular airplane, you know, a few planes kind of slipped through my fingers in my shopping, and I started to become pretty darn frustrated with the experience. I really thought I had a plane purchased in Chicago, and or at least I thought I had a hold on the plane to where I could have a inspection done. And then, you know, I was told the plane was making metal. And, you know, looking back on that, I'm not actually sure if it was. You know, you're dealing with a lot of different people and, you
right.
know, everything. There's some good demand for airplanes out there. So there's almost probably always someone willing to pay a little bit more money than the next person. And maybe someone outbid me on it in the end. But anyway, on this particular plane, it's a 1971 Cessna 150. And what really appealed me to this plane was I found it on Barnstormers, and there was a listing on there with no pictures. And it had a lot of great things. Probably find the ad, but most appealing was the 150 horsepower Lycoming engine. Because I was very comfortable with the 152 that I was training in with the 110 horsepower. But this particular airplane, you know, was advertised as a 150 horsepower Cessna 150. I'd been looking long enough to know that those were pretty rare and didn't come up for sale hardly ever in the, you know, time I was looking. And so I called the seller of the plane, and he told me, yep, he just listed it for sale, and that he was going to take some pictures and put them up, email them to me and put them online the next several days. Well, a couple of days went by, and you know, the pictures never really appeared in my inbox or on the website. So I gave him a call, and he said, yeah, you know what, I'm selling it to someone here locally in Seattle. It's like, you know, but the buyer has to, you know, check with his wife just to make sure that everything's cool. And this was on a Thursday afternoon. Okay. And, you know, I was pretty bummed out because I thought this was going to be pretty, you know, kind of exciting. And I was very interested in learning more about this airplane. Well, I was driving home from work that evening at about 7:30, and he called me and he said, well, you know, the purchaser's wife is, you know, not agreeing to this deal, so the plane's available. And I mean, I got to tell you, I foolishly told him right then and there on the phone, I'll take it.
Okay.
And, you know, he said, the price is the price. And I said, okay, I want it. And so then, you know, that was a little bit of a foggy memory, but I'm driving in my car home, and I'm starting to think, okay, I just committed to an airplane I've never seen. Don't even know much about it. I've never owned an airplane before, and what in the world am I doing? And then what am I going to tell my wife?
Yeah.
So, you know, what I did was I stopped, and I picked up a bottle of wine. I think I might have actually got some flowers, maybe.
There you go.
She could tell you for sure. And I came home, presented those, and then, as you know, the night proceeded, I told her what was up. At about 10:30 at night, that very same evening, I purchased airline tickets for the next morning to fly to Seattle, Washington, to see this airplane, because I'd come to the conclusion I need to set my eyes on this.
Yeah.
You know, have someone else look at it as well before I go much further with this. And so, you know, it was a very short night. I don't think I got a wink of eye of sleep. And, you know, the next morning I had some tight, I flew from Omaha to Salt Lake to Seattle, landed there, took an Uber up to Payne Field up in Everett, Washington, which is, you know, as I didn't know at the time, a very well-known, pretty famous airport. So I get up there, and the seller actually met me part of the way up there and drove me the rest of the way. And we get to this hangar, and there's 10 airplanes inside this relatively small hangar. And they're in various stages of condition and restoration and whatnot. Some are hanging from the ceilings, and there happens to be two Ferraris in there, a BMW, an old Land Rover.
Wow.
I mean, just an incredible and eclectic assortment of stuff. Well, the man who owned all this was no longer alive. He passed away of cancer, and he was a 37-year veteran of Boeing Corporation. He was an engineer there.
Oh, wow.
And the plane I was coming to look at was his basically commuter airplane, in which he would fly it out to an island where he had sort of a weekend home, and fly it back. You know, he'd fly out on Friday and come back early Monday morning. And this was just kind of his little, in a way, runabout plane. And so I looked at the plane. The executor of the estate, super great guy. We become good friends. I just had lunch with him last week. We went for a test flight in the plane. There was a local A&P that did a relatively informal pre-buy for me. And we can talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
You know, again, I'm really kind of taking a leap of faith here with a lot of this up to this point. But he did a compression check and walked me around the plane and everything, and showed me some areas of concern. And you know, a lot of our time was just spent talking about the man who was no longer alive, who used to own the plane. And, you know, and even looking at some of the other planes and cars and stuff that were in the hangar, I just kind of had a good feeling about it. And truthfully, foolish or not, I just did it. It's all worked out so far. I ended up catching a flight back home later that night. And then I, you know, as you know, didn't have my license. So I had to find a way to get that airplane from Seattle, Washington, all the way down, and, well, you know, on a direct line to Omaha, Nebraska, essentially. But I was talking to a lot of different ferry pilots. And in the winter, you know, there were very few people who would fly in a direct line. Some would go up through Canada. Some would go all the way down California and around. And so most ended up preferring a route, which was about a three-day route, that would take them down California, through Arizona, part of New Mexico, up through Kansas and everything. And so that's the route that the plane took.
Wow.
And yeah, that whole ferry experience was interesting anyway, because the gentleman I found, his name is Zach, he was actually based in Maine. And so he flew all the way from Maine to Seattle on a commercial flight, and then flew that Cessna 150 and stayed with friends and family on his trip back and around. And no, he was just trying to find time to build time on his log for what he was looking to do. You know, that was quite an ordeal in itself, was getting that plane here in January. And the night he arrived was actually January 1st, 2018. And the temperature was 6 below 0 when he landed. And he was cold.
Oh, yeah.
He got out of that airplane. So that's kind of when the, you know, fun started for me, you could say.
Well, that's a very interesting story. And it sounds like you met a lot of interesting people kind of during that whole transaction, too.
I most definitely did. Yeah. And, you know, I would have loved to have met the previous owner of my airplane because sounded like such an interesting person. And I mean, he actually has a lot to do with designing the wing of the Boeing 777, the carbon fiber wing.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, he sounded like a really, really cool person. But yeah, a lot of good things happened in that whole process. You know, it was just one of the best experiences of that was Christmas weekend. Okay, this was on Friday prior to Christmas, and traffic in Seattle was just absolutely horrendous. And so in order to get me back from Payne Field down to SeaTac, I mean, it was just gridlock. What Mark did for me, he had this beautiful Cessna 180. It's a 1958. And he says, look, I'll just fly you down to Renton Field. And so what we did with another one of his friends, Jeff, Jeff has an aerobatic airplane. I can't exactly remember what it is, but Jeff does a lot of races. In fact, he participates in the Reno Air Race. We flew in tandem from Painfield down to Renton, and I had never experienced anything to that. You know, we took off side by side. We flew in formation. We landed side by side. I mean, that alone
was
absolutely amazing. Those guys are going to have fish and chips at some great restaurant somewhere, some other strip airfield. But it was awesome.
So that kind of probably, those experiences probably inspired you more also, you know, to keep flying, and also that you made a good choice with this airplane.
Absolutely. There were just so many strange and coincidental things about this plane and the experience I can't even tell you. I mean, the tail number alone, it's 1911 Sierra. I mean, those numbers alone, I mean, have some significance in my life. And some deep ties, you know. There's so many things about the situation that just seemed like it was just meant to be.
Yeah.
And so every time I turned around, I mean, things were just working out for me.
Well, I must say, I mean, that's a fairly unusual scenario, typically, right?
Well, it's not over. there can always be surprises, you know.
Sure.
But I'm fine with that.
Got it. Yeah. Well, you're right. As Don would say, you know, it ain't over till the fat lady sings, right?
Right. Yeah.
So,
I mean, you know, the fun is the adventure, not the destination.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, so far, sounds like you're having a great adventure so far with the airplane and everything.
I most definitely do, yes.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
I just had lunch last week in Omaha with Mark, down in the old market in Omaha, because he almost never comes into Omaha because he flies large jets. But he had a flight that landed in Omaha, and it was also very strange. I email him about once a month. I happen to email him on this one day to ask him some questions, because he's really almost turned into my mentor, whether he knows it or not. asking him some questions about a tail dragger, because he flies that beautiful 180, and that's something I'm interested in. And he says, well, you know what? He says, I'm flying into Omaha tonight. He says, let's have lunch tomorrow.
Wow.
So, again, just coincidental.
Yeah.
I mean, things working out. So, we're pretty close acquaintances.
Very cool. So let's talk a little bit more about your airplane. You said it's got this upgraded engine. So tell us, if you can, maybe compare the performance of a typical 150 or 152 to this airplane that has the 320 on it.
Right. So the biggest difference that you'll notice in flying my 150 with the 150 horsepower engine is the climb. Okay. You know, in the 152, it would do the job. But this 150 with the upgraded engine, I mean, it just kind of jumps off the ground and really climbs out good. You know, when I started my training, it was fall in October. And so the 152's climb was totally fine, because I did a lot of my training, you know, from October to January before my plane arrived. And, you know, when my plane arrived in January, you know, my instructor took it for a test flight first, and she goes, I just cannot believe how that thing climbs out. She says, you know, I was at pattern altitude before I got halfway down the runway. Of course, and that's in some dense, cold air in Nebraska, you know, and everything. So, you know, right now it's very humid, especially for this late in the year. I mean, we've got almost 70% humidity some of these days. And so, you know, if I were, I'm 200 pounds. If I were flying that 152 with the 110 horsepower engine, there's no doubt about it, I'd be climbing out pretty slowly in these hot, humid Nebraska days. But my 150 with the 150 engine, it just really climbs out nice. I mean, I'm climbing out, you know, 1,100 feet per minute.
Wow.
You know, which is pretty good. In the winter, it'll do a lot better than that. It does very well. And so in terms of speed comparison, You know, this is a little bit faster airplane. I don't think it's that much faster because of the engine upgrade, but you know, my instruments are in miles per hour. Okay. And so I'll usually at my cruising, when I reach my cruising altitude, I'll turn my my engine speed back to like 2350 is about what I'll, you know, turn it back to. And I'll be at about 115 miles per hour airspeed. And, you know, depending on winds, you know, the ground speed varies, of course. Compared to the 152, I really never flew that airplane in the summer. So I can't necessarily do a very good comparison, because once I got this plane, I never went back to flying the other plane. And, you know, we've got a 172 I can go rent also. And I was thinking about doing that, but I've never really even gone to do that to get like signed off on that, because most of my flying I'm by myself. So the two-seater's completely fine, or I might have one of my girls with me. I mean, one's age 7, the other one's 3 years old. So I mean, you know, I don't really need much more in terms of space and everything.
Sure.
You know, one thing that does become an issue with this airplane though is if I want to take a friend for a ride. I mean, you know, it's at my size and at the useful load of the airplane, because the larger engine did add some weight to the plane.
Sure.
And it has, you know, I have an ADF still in it. I have two radios. I mean, it has quite a bit of stuff in the plane that's adding weight to it. I mean, my rated useful load is only 400 pounds. So, and it has long range fuel tanks as well. So I can put up to 39 gallons of fuel in there. So you can quickly become over gross if you're not careful. So that is a limiting factor of my plane. And that's why it's good for me when I'm in it most of the time by myself, or with one of my daughters, or my instructor is very, I mean, she's really small too. So we're okay. But I can't just load the wings up with fuel and grab a buddy and go. You know, I mean, that is, you know, a limiting factor that I must respect on this plane. So I took my father-in-law for a ride one time, but otherwise I'm not taking other full-size adults as myself in this plane.
Well, that's a common trade-off for any airplane, you know, the respecting the useful load capabilities and all that. I think you probably have a little smaller window to play with though in this airplane.
Right.
Now, just a side note, with the upgraded engine, what kind of changes were made to the POH, or at, you know, supplements added to the POH, or anything like that?
So when I got the plane, I mean, it came with two POHs. It does have a supplement as well. But one of the POHs was for a 172 and the other one's for a 150. So I, you know, it's kind of combining the two, because it's got essentially a 172 engine and a 150 airframe. But, you know, what I use is the 150 POH. I feel that that's going to be the more conservative one to use. And I just am always, you know, calculating my weight and balance carefully and to make sure I'm, you know, within that window.
And what kind of... what kind of fuel burn do you see? Because obviously the fuel burn is going to be slightly higher on on this engine than on the original engine that came with it. So do you use the 172 POH for fuel calculations, or how do you go with that?
Yes, I do. So for my calculations, I'll calculate 8 gallons per hour consumption, although I will go back and measure with the stick and the time and everything. And usually I actually, that's 8 is a little high. Usually I'm consuming around 6.5 gallons.
Okay.
But I always use the 8. I, you know, just want to be on the safe side. When I'm going anywhere, it's a big focus of mine to have plenty of fuel or just, you know, not go.
Absolutely. Sure. Well, interesting. So the, what are some things that you've learned from owning an airplane that maybe you didn't learn while renting an airplane? I know you only rented for a short time, but maybe is there anything you can tell us that some things that you thought were useful to know as an airplane owner.
Okay, I have to stop one moment because I'm thinking about that previous question with my answer to it for a moment. Because the reason I use in my calculations for 8 gallons an hour is because I do lots of takeoffs and landings. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm only consuming 6.5 is because, you know, I'm on downwind peeling that thing back a lot, you know, to 1500 RPMs or whatever. So I'm not, you know, that's where I'm achieving 6.5 gallons. But if I were going to get in it and go to, you know, some other city 200 miles away, that's why I use 8 gallons for my calculations. Because people might ask, you know, well, why in the world do you calculate the 8 when it's only using 6.5? At cruise, I think I'm probably, you know, much closer to 8. And then in terms of what I've experienced in terms of like owning the airplane, I mean, I don't regret it one moment. There's not one regret I have of buying that plane versus sticking with a rental. And you know what? I have encountered some expenses along the way too. My insurance, I was surprised how inexpensive it is. As a student pilot, I purchased the insurance for that airplane at $600 a year. I purchased it through the AOPA. You know, I've been told I could maybe even shop around and save some money, but they made it very easy, and not really having known how to navigate my way through the whole plane ownership thing, they were a great resource for me. And my instructor could fly it too, and you know, any other person can fly it. There's some hour limitations on there, but the only two people that have ever flown it are myself and my instructor. I've had I had replaced my attitude indicator. It was roughly $600 to do so. I installed an engine block heater for that airplane, and put new tires on it, and I had to have a little bit of brake work done to it as well. You know, I mean, that was close to $2,000. So there are surprises, but honestly, I feel that it's the trade-offs are worth it. Because if I just, the freedom that I have and the ability to just show up to the hangar when I want and take the plane up for 10 minutes, an hour, or whatever time frame I want is worth so much. You know, I stay in pretty close contact with the other students that I started training with. You know, the plane's not always available. Or, you know, if you go to rent the plane on the weekend, I mean, there's minimum times you have to rent the plane for. You don't just take off and get charged for necessarily what you fly if you want to go somewhere for a weekend. You know, there's a daily minimum charge. So all those things combined, and you know, sometimes the FBO is closed, and I might go up super early in the mornings. There's no doubt about it. Sometimes I'll go fly from 5 to 6 a.m. You know, and then come home and get ready for work and everything. And not owning my plane, I don't have that freedom and flexibility if I don't own it. The ownership has allowed me to just have a lot of flexibility and control over fitting the flying into my life. I mean, sometimes I just work 35 miles away from here, but I'll fly to a nearby airport, park the plane for the day, and then fly home after work, you know, so I use it as a little commuter too. But there's no way, having not owned that plane, I could do that.
Right. No, definitely. So going back to some of those maintenance things that you had to take care of, because, you know, I'm an AP, so I care about that stuff. Curious if you can tell us, you know, what prompted you, for example, to replace that attitude indicator?
Okay, well, it started to wobble a little bit, and I didn't necessarily think too much of that necessarily, but when it literally starts spinning around and around and around when you're up flying in the air, you know, there's a problem. And that time I was with my instructor, and she noticed it, that it was wobbling a little bit. And then we get up there and it really starts to spin. And, you know, comes a point where, you know, it just was obvious that thing needed to be replaced. So, and then in terms of why I did some brake work on it, we were getting ready for takeoff. And all of a sudden, one of the brakes locked up on, the left brake locked up on the plane. And we started to veer, you know, quickly to the left.
Yeah.
And so I got the plane stopped before we went off the runway. But, you know, it was pretty clear something was going on there too. And we got, you know, we got it unlocked, and we were able to actually go take off on a second attempt. But there was, and I'm going to tell you, I'm not the absolute most mechanical person in the world, far from. So I can't tell you exactly what was done to it. But, you know, I would like to do some of this stuff myself, and I know it's completely possible, and I could save some money doing it. But quite honestly, I don't even change the oil in my car. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why I should try to do something in the airplane. Mm. Because the risks for airplane are much greater outcome. It's a worse outcome if something goes wrong. So right. I've just come to the conclusion that if I'm not changing tires and oil and stuff on my car, why do I think I should do it on my airplane? And that's not to take away from people that do, because you know, it'd kind of be nice if I knew how to do that stuff, but I just kind of like choosing the 150. You sort of need to know your weaknesses, and and so I just feel that, you know, at this point in time, I'm not ready to do my own maintenance. I can pay someone to do it, and it saves me a lot of time, and I can just focus on the flying.
Mm. Have you considered doing any like owner-assisted maintenance with an AMP that's willing to do that? Which not, you know, a lot of them I guess aren't, but
yeah. See, that's the situation I have here is meeting someone who'd be willing to do it. We have a pretty small field here, and it doesn't seem like it's anything that's necessarily encouraged at our local shop. But I can, you know, it's something that I'm open to.
Sure. Well, whenever, you know, when you get the bug to start doing that, which, you know, you may get it, you know, on your own sometime.
Right.
Or at least like an owner assistant annual. I think you'll learn a lot about the airplane. There's so many benefits to it. Even if you just do it one time, you know, for just one annual, you'll just learn so much about the airplane, how it's all put together, and, you know, how everything interacts with everything else. And, you know, it would save you some money, too. So I'm guessing then, with that said, you haven't done an annual yet, correct?
No, I haven't. And, you know, that is something that's kind of a little bit of a slight fear I have is because I've read about, you know, your first annual on an airplane you just purchased, you know, with a new mechanic to this airplane. New to the airplane. And so, you know, that's a little bit of a concern of mine. I've got a little stash of cash sitting aside, and hopefully it's enough to take care of that, because there's no doubt about it. I haven't gone through that yet, and it is a concern of mine.
Mm. Yeah, and that's true, because typically your first annual is the most expensive for a variety of reasons. One could be less than perfect pre-buy. Of course, you know, that's one reason. Another reason would be, you know, you have different AMP IAs that have different perspectives on what's airworthy, what's not airworthy, what's a squawk, what's not a squawk. And so, you know, he might say, hey, this is not going to work for me. We need to fix this and we need to fix that. There's also likely, at least in most cases, some deferred squawks that have been deferred that now the new owner, you, would want to fix. So there's many reasons why that first annual could be more expensive. So, you know, we just got to see what happens. So I'd be interested to hear what the outcome is for you when annual time comes around.
Well, there's no doubt about it. Everything in this purchase has gone pretty good up to this point. But yeah. I realize in my mind that this could bring everything to a screeching halt. And, sure. I mean, it's a big concern of mine. And I'm not trying to just, you know, foolishly hop along here and say things are working out, because you know, in hindsight, I wish that I would have slowed down the purchase process a little bit, and that I would have you know, had you come look at the plane on my behalf, because the pre-buy that took place, there's no doubt about it, was done by someone at the local field and that is much more biased towards the seller than me.
Sure.
And so, you know, looking back in time, that is a regret I have, is that I wish I would have slowed things down a little bit. But I got wrapped up in it. I got wrapped up in all these things working out to my favor and just kind of moving ahead a little blindly and maybe overly trusting. Mm. And that's nothing against anyone that was involved in the sale. It's just, you know, the plane is the plane.
Right.
You know.
Well, then you find out how quickly the whole process unfolds. I mean, before you know it, like you said, the next day you are in, in Washington. And then, you know, the process happens quick, and it's easy to lose track of what the priorities are, you know. And, of course, too, you had been looking for a while, and you didn't want to lose the opportunity to get the airplane and have someone else get it. And as you mentioned, and as is what is being seen now in the market, is that, you know, these airplanes, especially good airplanes, are selling quickly, and you don't want them to, you know, fall from you like some of the other airplanes that you mentioned had done.
Absolutely. I'm sure good airplanes and not so good of airplanes are selling quickly right
now. Oh, well, that's very true too. Yeah. I mean, it's going both ways, but the good airplanes especially are not on the market. I mean, at least if they're perceived to be good airplanes, that is, you know.
Right.
It's crazy what we can uncover on them sometimes. But so you mentioned too that and this is an important point, that the purchase price is just really the cost of admission, right? So can you maybe give us a ballpark figure of what this airplane cost to purchase, what the sales price was, and then you had mentioned some of the maintenance expenses that you've run into. And, you know, so maybe give us an idea of what the purchase price was and what the, maybe if you want to break it down into hourly costs or what you've spent so far in fixed and variable costs, just to give us an idea, because we compare a lot of different airplanes, and obviously this is on the lower end of the spectrum in terms of price and in operating costs and so on. So maybe this would be good for our listeners to get an idea of, hey, you know, that Mooney that costs several thousand dollars a year just to fly versus a more economical airplane like this 150.
Right. So, you know, if you do some market research, Cessna 150s are offered for as little as, I don't know, $10,000-$12,000, all the way up to over $40,000. Mm-hmm. Okay. My particular airplane, I mean, I paid $30,000 for it, which is on the high side of any Cessna 150 out there. And there's no doubt I was paying a lot for the engine. But that being said, a lot of people who aren't pilots find out and own an airplane. They're like, oh my gosh, you own an airplane? That's crazy. And most of the time, you know, they're of the assumption that you can't buy an airplane for much less than $130,000.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that if you are looking for something, you can still find a good airplane in the $20,000 to $30,000 price range. You just have to be willing to accept those trade-offs that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be willing to be okay with, you know, being at the lower end of the spectrum. But I got to tell you, there's a lot of people that I've met that have much more expensive airplanes, and they just kind of want to go slow and look around also. I started my instrument training here, but I'm just primarily a VFR pilot. I'm not going to fly really in any weather. The reason I'm doing my instrument training is if I get caught in something by surprise. But I don't use this for business. I'm not really using it to travel with my family anywhere. It's pretty much just to go experience the joy of flying and go to these fly-in breakfasts.
Mm-hmm.
And meet other people, and I enjoy the camaraderie of it. And I do want to get to that point where I can do some minor work on the plane, but you know, I have no interest in installing. You know, I have a friend with a 182 that has G1000 panels in it. I mean, that's great for him, but that is of no interest to me. I actually like the nostalgia of the steam gauges. I want to learn how to fly a tail dragger. You know, I'm just on a little bit different. You just have to find your stride in this and figure out where you can fit in and enjoy it, and whether you're spending a lot or a little to do that. I for me, it's a hobby, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that answers the question. I guess about the price of the plane. Okay, other expenses I have. I mean, I chose to I have my own tea hanger. I spend $180 a month for that.
Oh, wow. That's reasonable.
I guess I spend about another $30 or $35 in electricity for it.
Mm.
the $600 a year for insurance. I really don't put it down in a per hour basis because I have a lot of fixed costs.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm going to do think like the attitude indicator that failed, the brakes, all that. I'm going to do that stuff. I mean, so I'm not really, I could at the end of the year break this down and figure out, okay, I've gone 150 hours and I spent, you know, this on it and there's my per cost. But I'm not calculating it as I go. One thing that I didn't mention that this plane is also extremely economical. It has the autogas SDC.
Oh, okay.
So that makes a pretty big difference as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say. Now, something that I would recommend for sure, just in general, but is do make sure the mechanic that does your annual does a good bore scope of the engine. That's okay. That's going to be important. Mm-hmm. And it only take, you know, the spark plugs come out anyway for the compression test, you know, so it takes just a couple seconds to throw a little camera down in there. But
sure.
Yeah, definitely. Now, real quick, speaking of STCs, with that upgraded engine, did the airplane come with all the paperwork that supported that engine upgrade, so the STCs and then any of the 8130s or the airworthiness documents for the engine and so on?
Yes, yes, I have a very thick stack of papers and all the STCs for that.
Yeah, cool. Because that's important. Like, you know, when you're looking at airplanes with any kind of upgrade or modification or alteration, you know, making sure that you have all the documents is going to save you a lot of hassle for that first annual inspection and beyond. You know, when you go to sell the airplane, if you ever get ram checked, if there's ever any kind of incident that the insurance company gets involved in, all that sort of thing, you got to make sure that all the paperwork is there,
right?
And or at least accessible, you know, in some fashion. And you also have to make sure that you're following the limitations and conditions of that STC, you know, instructions for continued airworthiness and any kind of additional inspection for that particular upgrade. So anyway, now with the fuel burn that you get, let's just round it up to, like, you know, 7 gallons an hour, right? And so you guys can do the math out there listening. You can do the math based on whatever fuel prices are in your area, you know, so that would be your direct cost. Does the airplane burn a lot of oil for you? Like, do you have to add, you know, a quart of oil every 5 or 10 hours or anything like that?
About every 8 hours, I'll add a third of a quart.
Okay, so that's not bad at all. So that's something to, you know, maybe add into your cost. Maybe not for you, but for someone that's really interested in tracking their costs, and because they use the airplane for business or whatever, and so those things are a little bit more of a priority then. But, you know, so anytime you have to add oil, any other consumables that you would, you know, have to add or replace on a regular basis. Is there anything else you want to tell us about the airplane that we should know?
I will say, prior to owning a plane, I foolishly kind of thought, you know, you can just probably do what you want to your plane. And it is, I did find out how strict it is, you know.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, I wanted to change some light bulbs, like my landing and taxi light burned, one of the two of them burned out. And, you know, I did switch over to an LED, even, you know, did that myself. It was pretty easy, but it just, there's so much restriction on certified, when your plane's a certified plane, on what you can and can't put in that into the plane. You don't just change things out because you want to.
That's true. And something to keep in mind, even simple things, it's got to be the right one that's approved for the airplane. Whether you agree with it or not, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. Depends on what it is. That's the way we have to play it so that we're being airworthy, at least, and legal and safe. Yeah, so that's definitely something to keep in mind. And that's something to keep in mind when you're looking at the airplane, too, before you buy it, is to make sure that all the pieces and parts and what have you is the correct stuff. And as Don would say, well, you could put whatever you want in there, but I'm gonna find it, you know, I'm gonna figure it out.
So, right, yeah. So that's where I kind of say this first angle is a little bit of a fearful event coming up.
Sure, well, you know, fortunately, it shouldn't be, I would guess, not too terrible. It sounds like the airplane was fairly well maintained and everything. And fortunately, too, that 150 is not a very expensive airplane in general, and parts are still very, very available. I wouldn't anticipate it being anything crazy. So, you know, Mitch, I really appreciate you spending some time with us. Usually a question I ask at the end is, what advice do you have for someone that's thinking about buying their first airplane?
Well, I would say just do it. But probably do it in a little bit more calculated process. I know this is hard too, because much like me, and I've listened to your podcasts, it's happened to other people too, you know, is you get emotionally wrapped up in this
sure.
process. Mm-hmm. And if you lose one plane or another plane, or you feel like one, you know, slipped through your fingers, it really is hard for that not to affect you moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so really talking to someone like the pre-buy guys, maybe a broker,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't know. I mean, entering this, I was like, why would anyone use a broker? I really couldn't figure that out, you know, because in my business, brokers just add to the price.
Okay? Sure,
and,
sure, sure.
And there are brokers everywhere in my business, but it didn't really make much sense until kind of having been in this a little bit more. And, you know, it's good to have a very non-emotional tie to the process. You know, I think the goal is to buy the right plane for your mission at the time.
Yes.
And you know, I don't believe that this has to be the forever plane.
Right.
You know, I think some people get a little wrapped up into buying maybe more than they need because they think they're going to grow into it. I don't know. I'm a little different than that. I would just buy what fits now.
Yeah.
Worry about the next one later, because as hot as the market is when you're buying these things, that also means they're pretty liquid when you want to sell.
Right.
You know, I've seen some planes sell locally here pretty quickly at some high prices, and it's just a sign that when I want to change, it's totally possible.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So.
No, you're absolutely right. And I would, in most situations, completely agree with you. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's great advice. So, Mitch, thanks again for being here. We appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you soon. And best of luck with everything. And keep us up to date with the airplane.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Perfect. And thanks again to Mitch for spending so much time with us. And, of course, thank you for listening. Don and I always love doing this podcast for you guys. You make it a lot of fun. Now, if you'd like to join the conversation, ask your questions, or do an interview about your airplane, send an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com. And if you're a patron of the show, you heard the unedited version of this interview, so we hope you enjoy that. And if you're not a patron yet, head on over to patreon.com/prebuyguys. Anyways, that's going to just about cover it for us this week. Thanks again for hanging out with us. We really appreciate it. And we definitely hope to see you soon. In fact, NBAA starts in just a couple days from now, and I've already made some plans to meet some of you guys. So if you're going to be in town in Orlando during NBAA, let me know so we can meet. Anyways, until next time, stay safe and keep the greasy side down. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Intel Podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope that you'll subscribe to the show and follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter by searching Pre-Buy Guys. To access show notes, archives, and other free resources, head on over to airplaneintelpodcast.com. To get answers to your questions, drop us a line on social media or send an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com. You can also reach us by phone at 904-290-3870. And remember, owning an airplane doesn't have to be hazardous to your wealth.